Welcome back, everyone, to Constructive Uncoupling, the podcast devoted to amicable divorces. I'm Judith Weigel, your host and amicable divorce expert. Why? Because that's all I do, amicable divorces. I was attending a seminar recently for the Los Angeles Marriage and Family Therapists, a group I have belonged to for years, not because I'm a therapist, but because as a mediator in divorce, I need to know a lot about the psychology of the people walking in my office so that I can offer the greatest amount of sensitivity and understand where they're coming from as much as I can in my role as mediator. I was completely blown away by our guest today, Dr. Steve Wolf, PhD. Welcome, Dr. Wolf.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
I was blown away by Dr. Wolf because he was talking about couples. Most specifically, he started with anger management and anxiety management. And as any of you know, going through divorce, there is anger and there is anxiety. And then there's just a lot of questioning about how to even perceive the behavior of our soon-to-be ex-spouses. And I think Dr. Wolf is going to shed an enormous amount of light on this topic of the couple evolving, because he does specialize in this, so that you can better understand your journey ahead if you've already entered the field of divorce or are about to. So Dr. Wolf, let's start with this. I want to quote you, and I would like you to please explain this to our audience. The couple exists as an energetic body, while each person in the couple comes from a family, which in and of itself is an energetic body. Let's start our discussion with that.
Well, I believe the couple, I think of the couple as a third body. There's a poem you can Google by Robert Bly called The Third Body. And I think of it as an infinity sign. So it gets created. And I believe if we had the right photographic equipment, we could actually photograph it. So the couple exists in the same way that the family exists. So when you have a breakdown in the family, let's say with divorce, there's a tearing away. I think of in Avatar, if you had your own special creatures, there were these tendrils that would extend out from your fingertips that would allow you to jump on your, what was a horse. Those tendrils get torn away in divorce. They get torn away between the two folks that are getting separated and divorced. And the children involved also feel a tearing away of the fabric of their being. It's very deep and very subtle. So it's understanding that the couple exists and is going through a transition. Part of my approach to the couple and looking at the couple existing is that there are stages of couple development, like infant, child, adolescent, adult. Are four stages of individual development. I believe that stages of couple development, like there's formation. I say couples are like omelets. You don't just have an omelet by cracking some eggs in a pan. It takes heat over time. It takes heat over time to create a couple, this energetic field. Once it forms, now you have expectations of each other. You have patterns that get created. And it's like going into a spaceship together. You're joining together. This particular spaceship looks like an eggshell. It's like an egg. So you get into the eggshell with your partner, and you live inside the eggshell. And as the result of growth and love and development and change and kids and development of personality and career and all of that, one or both of the partners feel like they're getting suffocated inside the eggshell. The agreement that you signed when you got married to be this kind of person and to be that kind of person is no longer viable. You feel like you're getting suffocated. And so the eggshell cracks. This is where the relationship ends for 50% of the people that are married. The old marriage won't work anymore. It's a couple in crisis. So the evolving couple, you have a couple options. When the eggshell cracks, meaning you can't tolerate it anymore, there's, again, four options as I see it. One, you split like 50% of married couples. Two, you agree to tolerate the patterns as they are without making any changes, which is to continue to suffer. It's an agreement to suffer together. Three, I think of this as the Humpty Dumpty option, where you try to put it back together again, and you learn how to be a better listener, how to be more considerate, how to deal with your anger. And four is you say, I'm going to transform. I'm going to go and, in my lighter moments, I say it's like going from the eggshell to the chicken yard. We're going to go to a chicken yard. There's a lot more room. There's still boundaries. But in this transformation stage, it means both people are ready and able to look at how they create their own experience. So this is the ending of, it's your fault that you do this and your fault that you do that. And it's his and it's hers, and there's blaming, projection, anger, and withdrawal. So the transformation has to do with personal growth and transformation. It's hard work, and it's not for everybody. But that's how I see the couple as the third body and the family as an energetic field.
Okay, so in the third aspect of the crisis and breakdown therapy, trying to put the relationship back together, Humpty Dumpty, we know that the divorce rate is 50% on first divorces, up to 70% on third divorces. But in terms of this stage three using therapy, what percentage of people are actually successful putting the relationship back together again?
I don't know. I can't answer that question, but many people who don't want to split, let's say you have a couple of children, you have a mortgage, you have a lot of reasons. Usually it's money and children to keep the marriage together. Maybe you can learn how to coexist better. Many people do. Depends on the therapist that you choose, depends on your willingness to work together. And hopefully in that process, you do some of what the transformational work is about. You learn, what am I doing? The key is looking at yourself, taking a selfie, looking at yourself, what am I doing to create these patterns that are so painful? So I would say couples therapy, which is what many couples do, is a viable option. You see if it works. If not, then it's time to preferably find a mediator rather than go straight for a divorce lawyer.
Well, a divorce lawyer is good because they have to teach you the law so that when you go to the mediator, you're well informed when you start making your compromises and your decisions.
So, agreed. Yeah. Both. I always recommend that so that you're informed and you know what you're entitled to.
And then, this is interesting. I use this phrase all the time in mediation. I say, mediation and divorce are issues of compromise. Well, divorce is an issue of compromise. Mediation is the opportunity to share those compromises. But the emotion and the reason for the divorce are the backdrop to the negotiations. So what you said about self-awareness is so very important when you get into the divorce stage.
Yeah, especially if you're going to be co-parenting with each other. Because what's in the best interest of your children is the more consistency, the less antagonism between divorced parents, the better it is for the children. There's no doubt about it.
Absolutely. And you know, parents don't even realize, first of all, how angry and upset they are to the point where they think they're doing the right things for their kids when they say to their kids, tell your father that I can't have you next Tuesday. They actually think that's okay.
I would challenge that. I don't know if they're thinking at all. I think they're reacting because they're overwhelmed. They don't want it. They don't know how to engage in a dialogue with the father over those kinds of details. And they set the kid up. But I agree with you. It's the less involved the children are in the dynamics between the parents, the better off it is. And anger is, you know, anger is misunderstood. Anger gets a bad rap.
There's good anger and bad anger. Go ahead.
Anger is a secondary emotion. This is a little controversial. Primary emotions are happy, sad, and anxious. Everybody agrees on that. Of the 30 books or more that I've read on anger, I'd say 3/4 of the authors agree anger is a secondary emotion. What does that mean? It means that anger is camouflage. You have the emotion itself, the power of the emotion produced by the limbic brain. I say the limbic brain produces emotion the way the reptilian brain produces heartbeats. You can't help the power of what you feel emotionally. Anger serves as a camouflage for primary emotion. The primary emotion could feel like anxiety. I'm anxious about getting divorced. Loss, sad, lack of self-worth, all these very sensitive issues. But folks are unwilling or unable to deal with them directly. So the power of the emotion comes out as anger. So anger allows you to discharge vulnerable emotions. It also camouflages vulnerable emotions. There is a an advertisement for myself. There's a YouTube by Dr. Steve Wolf on something about mollifying anger in and out of the therapy session. It's about a 10-minute presentation I did. You can check it out. And I talk about my own history with anger. But when you begin to understand that your anger is a way for you to camouflage the fact that you're really hurt, you're really abandoned, you're really anxious, you're really alienated, now you can have a communication that works between two adults that are going through a process. When we're angry at each other, there's no communication. It's sad. It's just discharge of energy and a repetition of dysfunctional patterns. So it's, you know, to enter into a mediation process with someone who's sensitive to the psychology is a real gift.
Well, thank you. And I am very fascinated about this. Everything about human beings fascinates me. And so that's why my ears perked up when you were talking about anger and anxiety. So let's address the mediation process for divorce, because I have a couple coming in for the fourth time next week. He is filled with anger, but not just at her, not just because of the divorce. He has this issue, and it permeates everywhere in his life. And now he has an opportunity, because he's getting divorced, to really address it, because it hits at the core of his personal life. And there is one teenage child involved. So how can I, as a mediator, knowing he's going to get angry — I've already addressed the anger, I said this is counterproductive. If you can't rein yourself in — this was the third mediation — let's not spend time and money. Let's let you deal with your anger and then come back. Well, they want to come back next week. We're almost at the finish line for decisions. Any tips for me?
Well, I have a couple of questions I ask for people who are in denial. One is, could be denial of anything. So in this case, there's denial that I have an anger problem. I would say, what would it take for you to recognize that you had an anger issue that needed to be attended to? What would give you the information you needed to say to yourself, I have an anger problem? What would it be? Well, if I threw a brick through a window, okay, I'm being extreme. If I hit my kid, if I yelled at a cop, or whatever, you decide, what is it that would indicate to me that I had a problem? Second question, what would you do for yourself if you realized you had a problem? What action would you take? Third question, what are the consequences for you of not taking that step? And let the person look at the inevitability and reflect on how it requires — they say, how many shrinks does it take to change a light bulb? One, it has to want to change. What will it take for this person who is in denial to recognize I need to address something within myself. So these are my questions for people in denial. Identify what the trigger is that will let you know I got a problem. 2, what would I do? 3, what are the consequences of not doing it? And maybe 4 is what would stop me from taking care of myself once I realized I had a problem. So that's what I would say to you. Flip it around rather than trying to tell him and have him ask himself, how would I know?
Okay. How does his wife deal with him as he becomes very volatile? How should they, because people listening have this problem.
Yeah. So for this, I have a lot of sayings. This one I like, fool me once, shame on me. Fool me twice, shame on you. Once I know, first of all, if there was physical violence, you're shaking your head. No. Okay.
No, sorry about that. This is audio, not video. No, there has not been physical violence.
Okay, so shame on me is if I allow myself to remain in a situation where I feel like I'm being attacked or disrespected or pushed away or threatened, I'm doing that to myself. I don't want to subject myself to what it feels like when I stay around you when you're volatile, even if you don't think you are. So this isn't about you. This is about me. I don't want to allow myself to be treated this way. So as soon as I hear your voice hit that octave, I'm leaving. I'll be back in 20 minutes and see if we can settle down. But I'm not going to submit myself to this anymore. I'm not going to blame you anymore. You have your own issue. I'm going to take responsibility. If I don't like how it feels, I'm going to remove myself. That's my approach.
That is exceptional. That is exceptional. That, to me, is the parallel to BIF, brief, informative, friendly, and firm. That's Bill Eddy, mediator, social worker, family law divorce attorney, has written many books on divorcing people, high conflict people with personality disorders. And that's exactly what you said. And that makes so much sense because A, you're not blaming the other person. And if there are any abandonment issues that the angry person has, you're not really abandoning them. You're going to stay with them. You're going to return. You're coming back after you take care of yourself by removing yourself temporarily, briefly, from a difficult situation to be in.
That is unpleasant for you. You don't like the way it feels. If you don't remove yourself, the next question I would ask is, what is stopping you from making how you feel a priority? Why would you stick around? I refer to it as keeping your finger in the electric socket. Once you get a shock, you want to take your finger out of the socket. Why would you remain in that situation? And then people have their own reasons for not, I don't want him to be abandoned. I'm afraid if I left, he'll be more volatile. I'm afraid if I don't stay, he really will abandon me. I mean, we could make up a half a dozen reasons. But the challenge is to take full responsibility for your own decision to stay. So what I would propose is learning how to identify when you feel unsafe, when you feel you're being aggressed, and remind yourself, this is my moment. I have a choice right now. I can allow myself to continue to feel this way, or I can remove myself. How do I want to do it? My function as a therapist is to help you make conscious decisions. It's not to tell you what to do.
But to help you understand why you're staying and why you're not going, if staying is the choice.
That's right. That's more of a therapy question. It's not as so simple as when you feel like you're being disrespected, take care of yourself. Because the consequences of not leaving are you will get pissed off at yourself for not taking care of yourself. We don't like it when we disrespect ourselves. But in relationship, it's easy to blame him. He's getting angry. He's still angry. He doesn't stop being angry. Versus, I'm still staying. I'm allowing myself to be treated this way. I'm afraid to remove myself. So the shift for me as a therapist is to help you take full responsibility for your choices. Because there'll be times when you'll say, oh, it's okay, for whatever the reasons are.
Right. So I want to go into for a minute the reason why some people may be very angry or very volatile. and have a difficult time in intimate relationships. You said something that made me smile broadly when I was attending the seminar. And you said, well, the family is an energetic body unto itself, and I sometimes refer to it as the loony bin. And I smiled broadly because I have a very dear friend who's also a psychotherapist. She's done it for 40 years, Kathy Memel. And she talks about the family tree and how we are branches and leaves from this tree from which we grew and were nurtured, and we carry aspects of the family with us without even knowing. We could watch aberrant behavior from our parents, and somehow we become our parents when we are in that situation. I love that you called it the loony bin, though, because don't we all feel like that at times? Let's address that we are products of our family, our upbringing, so that A, we can understand ourselves, and B, our spouses can understand us and our behavior.
Now, that's a challenge. Do you have, for you to be in a relationship where, first of all, people are understanding how I'm reacting to you. I'm pissed off right now. I'm reacting to you because my father had an anger problem and I realize it, but I need to take a walk because I don't want to lay it on you. That's a big deal when somebody understands themselves. It's a bigger deal. This is what happens when we go into the chicken yard, when we have that relationship where we're taking responsibility. If I understand you're sensitive, you just had something happen at work, so you came home and you felt a little off your game, and I understand that. So when you maybe snap a little bit, I give you a little room because I understand you're sensitive. To have a couple that is understanding each other is really a gift because it gives you more space to be an individual. It doesn't mean you're less responsible for how you treat each other, but it adds a whole other component. And I think it's all too infrequent. So the value of couples work, not necessarily doing my program, the value of any kind of couples therapy is at the very least to understand each other better. Reasonable goal to go to couples therapy for that reason.
But the family that you came from, when my friend, my colleague Kathy, talked to me about the family tree, I would just, when I'm listening to people talk to me about the behavior of their spouse, and in my non-therapeutic internal response, oh, maybe there's a personality disorder. Okay, this behavior sounds like certain categories of behavior that I've heard about, read about, and listened to therapists talk about. But then I just ask those basic questions. So did you get to know their parents, your spouse's parents? What was this like? Did you see this behavior in the parents? And all of a sudden the light bulb goes on. Oh my gosh, yes, they start making the connection. Why, yes, this is how he or she has told me they experienced their family life. I said, okay, no, doesn't forgive, but at least you can understand and possibly start behaving differently than thinking it's all about you and you're the victim. Am I going down the right road here for people to
start opening
up?
Well, when you say you can start to, first of all, it says in the Old Testament, the sins of the fathers are visited upon the sons and daughters for seven generations. So we inherit the patterns of behavior that we experience in the loony bin. Everybody's raised in a loony bin of some kind or another. I think any kind of introspective psychotherapy will agree that a huge component of the psyche of identification of personality is created before we're 5 years old, meaning it is established by how we experience ourselves in the bosom of our family. How many incidents do we remember from before we were 5 years old? Five? 15? 25?
Yes.
No, people don't remember 25. And this is 5 years, 24/7, 365. We don't have any of these memories, so we suppress them. We are formed by our ability to deal with the emotions that we experienced in the family of origin. And this is the challenge of our internal development. So we form what I call a protector saboteur, which is like a suit of emotional psychological armor that we put on and we identify. We're in the suit of armor. We forget that we're there. We become the suit of armor in order to protect ourselves from the anxiety, the aggression, the depression, the whatever it is that we experienced in the family of origin. We learn how to protect ourselves. We become that emotional suit of armor. Everybody goes through that. What not everybody goes through is a later stage where we realize it is this emotional suit of armor that is sabotaging me. It is the patterns that I developed to protect myself in my family of origin that are now getting in my way in relationship. This is the value of individual work to deal with couples problems. When you have two people in a relationship, both of them attempting to look at their own responsibility, you have a new foundation for relationship, which is sharing the vulnerability that happens when you begin to tap those old places within ourselves. So you're this partner that you chose because she was cute or he was handsome or he was rich, he was this, he was that. That's just your welcoming in card. The real challenge is, can we grow together? Can we evolve together in our later years? Can we explore who we are as individuals and as mature adults? And a huge part of that is tending to how we felt it was being us when we were little kids. Because we experience ourselves as little kids, but we think the experiences have to do with the present. So let's say your wife wants to go out with the girls to have a cup of tea. She's not home for dinner. You feel abandoned. You say she's abandoning you. You felt abandoned because you were a latchkey kid, not because she's not home for dinner. But you don't know that the feeling of abandonment is a re-experiencing of what it was like when you were 2 or 5 or 7. You think that the feeling of abandonment is about what's going on in the present. I hope I'm not going too quickly here.
No, you're not. You're making perfect sense. Here's what I was thinking. I was thinking, you know, let's put more importance on developing self-awareness and doing it through therapy, if in fact we do have aspects of our personality that we even say, God, I'd love to change, just love to change this, because we are so complex. We need help. We need help understanding ourselves. And that thing about vulnerability, I don't know that you could talk about it enough.
Yeah, it helps. I think of the therapy in my occupation as a necessary luxury. And as a therapist, I think of myself, most therapists see themselves from the point of view of the medical model. The medical model says you have a problem, you find a doctor who diagnoses you, treats you, and cures you of the problem. My orientation as a adult developmental psychologist is to look at stages of development and the crises that we meet at different stages, so that we can grow. It's all about growth and maturing into becoming the spirit that we really are, into becoming connected to what I like to think of as our birthright, which is that conscious spark of the divine, as the Sufis say it. So to explore your childhood and the impact it has on your present identity is an entryway. Is an entryway into the work that is a promise of what, and when you have a partner to share it with, it's invaluable. I think sometimes I caution myself, but I don't know if you can do the same level of work if you're not in a relationship as you can when you're in a relationship.
Because the relationship is the mirror back to you.
Totally. So much intimacy. The love, the sex, the enmeshment of identity and family and all this stuff, you really get to look at yourself in ways that I don't know. Now, hopefully it's not true. Hopefully what I'm saying is not true. And people do get to do that same level of work. But I think this is not appreciated about the reason to be in a relationship, is to get a good look at yourself and give you the opportunity to take on, like those questions I asked, what is it about yourself that you need to look at in order to be the best version of yourself? And there's something about being in relationship that allows us to do that, that I don't know that is available if we're not.
I think I agree with you for this reason. Not that you can't work on yourself as an individual without being in a relationship. Yes, you can, because you do have other relationships. You have sibling relationships, friends, work relationships. You have that. But the intimate relationship, the one we have with a special partner, really draws out of us things that would not be in play as intensely as we are in an intimate relationship. And so, I just think back of those relationships that started for me, and I think everybody can identify with this. They're so fabulous at the beginning. They're just so, you're so high because you feel like you're open and you're blossoming. And when you feel safe enough to be vulnerable,
and your brain,
and to get out of jail free card.
Your brain is producing all these juicy neurotransmitters. So you are in love. But remember, for me, a couple is like an omelet. You don't have an omelet by cracking eggs in a pan. You don't have a relationship because you fell in love with somebody after 2 or 6 or 8 weeks. It takes about 6 months before this coagulation happens, before this energetic field actually is created. Because I've had this conversation with many people. You can think you fell in love with so-and-so, and after it was great for 2 months, for 3 months, for 4 months, it ended. After a while, you can hardly remember her name. You can't remember the names of the people that you met and I dated. And then it's, I dated her for 2 months or 3 months. So it's understanding that to be in a couple is a developmental octave. It's something that happens. It's not automatic. People don't understand that. Until the couple forms, you could say you are relating with each other, you're forming a relationship, you're getting to know each other. It's exploration, but it's not a couple in my mind.
All right, now they're in the fourth stage of the crisis breakdown, and they decide they have to get a divorce. And you were saying that now there's another paradigm shift, that wanting to split is a stage unto itself.
Yes.
Could you explain?
To review it, it's the eggshell cracks. I agreed, for instance, when we were dating and when we first got married, it was okay with me that you lost your temper. I would deal with it. It's not okay with me anymore. I can't tolerate it. Or I agreed. I would do all the housework because you go out and do the work. You go out and you earn money. It's not working for me anymore. I can't do all the housework. I need you to participate. I don't want to maintain that agreement anymore. Or I don't want to be the only one that earns an income. I think I want you to go get a job. The old contract that we originally signed up for is no longer viable. We can't continue to be the person that we were when we agreed to be married 5 or 10 or 20 years ago. So the eggshell cracks. I can't do it anymore. It's causing me too much pain. It's suffocating me. It's killing me. I need it to end. That's the stage of the development of the couple that I feel is natural. It's not unnatural to be done. It's natural. It's a stage. The question is, how do you navigate it? Do you tolerate it? Do you try to Humpty Dumpty it? Do you split and get divorced? Or do you do this thing that sounds like, I refer to it sometimes as Mission Impossible, where you try to discover who we are as individuals now, as adults, that we weren't before, and provide that as a new foundation for relationship. Who are we now? It's been 10 or 20 or 30 years. Who are we now? Can the love bond that we had be reclaimed so that we continue to grow and evolve with each other now? Because we're different people now. Let's share that with each other. Let's figure out how to take responsibility for patterns I picked up from the loony bin, from my parents, who got it from their parents. Can we do that? So there's a new foundation for relationship. That's the new relationship. That's the transformation.
But they can't do it. They have decided to get...
Can't do it. I don't like it.
Yeah.
Can't do it. For instance, I can't do it because you have an alcohol problem and it's intolerable for me. I can't do it because you're so insensitive to my thoughts and my feelings that I'm not willing to put up with it anymore. I don't want to do it to myself anymore. I can't do it because I can't live with the anxiety I have not knowing whether you're going to do this or that. So I'm done. I don't want to do that next step with you anymore. Let's end it. Either I'll go on as an individual or I'll try to find a partner that will give me what I want.
And then this is what I find fascinating. So that person who initiates and says pretty much what you just said, for some reason says that he or she got really angry. I don't understand. Why are they so mad? Couldn't they see the relationship isn't working anymore?
And your question is?
Why are they saying this? Why are they surprised that their spouse is upset? Can't we put this back together? No, I have to go. Can't you accept this?
Can't accept it. Well, why? Let me go back to your proposal, which was why is she or he so angry? When we go back to anger as a secondary emotion, to say, you know what? This person had their heart broken. He had his heart broken. He doesn't know how to deal with the pain. He feels abandoned, alone, alienated, betrayed. Can't deal with those feelings. So it erupts his anger, is one explanation. Most of the time when I see anger, it's kind of like if I point a finger at you, they say I'm pointing three fingers back at myself. I'm angry for how I take care of myself. I'm not treating myself in a respectful manner. For instance, when you get angry and I tolerate it, I'm angry at myself for tolerating it. I take the anger out on you. But really, it's my own reticence to honor my own needs. So this is stuff that would come out after working on yourself for a while. It's very challenging to work on yourself and take these things, responsibilities seriously.
I agree.
The reason people might do it as a couple most of the time is for the children or for financial consequences. Because you could be totally fed up with this person. I know her. I know him well. I don't want to do it anymore. The reason to make a go of it is what's the effect it's going to have on our children? What's the effect it's going to have on our standard of living? And those are really two big motivators that account probably for most of the people that go into therapy with each other.
Yes, and you nailed it. And those are the two big issues surrounding divorce and where the fear comes from. When you have two people, what I have found that when you have two people that can easily sustain their own independent lifestyles, you know, once the divorce happens, there seems to be, at least in my office, less arguing and fewer problems making the divorce settlement so that they can move forward and conclude. And, you know, children in my own family, children I've listened to, a lot of times when we're very much concerned and want to protect the children against a divorce, a lot of times the kids like a calmer household. They'll deal with two households because it's calmer, at least in one, generally.
Yeah, I don't think there's any cookie cutter right way of doing it.
Yeah.
The answer is it depends.
Right, true. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it depends on who the parents are. It depends on their ability to deal with their own feelings about each other and co-parent without letting their vulnerabilities and their fears and their anger intrude. Depends on their ability to communicate. And even if you do these things well, it could be the marriage isn't working out for some reason or another.
And that's okay. I watched several videos on just children being interviewed about their parents' divorce from age 5 to age 13. Just kids, no adults, answering these questions. And all the things we thought our kids would be concerned about, they did say, are we going to stay in the same school? What if I forget something? It's at my other parent's house. I need it for school the next day. Can I still have my friends? You know, all the normal things a kid would worry about. And so all these kids on all these different videos said the exact same thing. Eventually, at the end of the day, none of that mattered. Except that their parents got along. That's all they cared about. If their parents got along, they could deal with all the divorce issues. Mm-hmm. So simple, yet so difficult to do. Mm-hmm. So for those that have anger and high-end anxiety as part of the emotional fabric of the divorce, and I know everything is different, but what I tell people, and tell me if I'm right, tell me what you've experienced, in time, if you don't have a serious personality disorder, the anger does kind of calm down. And if you have the time before you finish the divorce, take a break. Everybody go to their own corners with a little time out until you can process and then come back and it's a little calmer making decisions. Have you found that to be true?
Yeah, if your emotions are overwhelming you, getting in the way of you making agreements or deciding on logical balance points and compromises, then by all means. But dealing with your emotions, I wonder what percentage of divorces occur because one or both partners don't know how to deal with their emotions. I would say it's a lot. And that is the cause of the breakup in the first place. So I think part of what is required of someone like yourself is to somehow spin some magical formula to help these folks deal with their emotions as you guide them through the process. So some people will want to get it over quickly, and other people will need the time, and there's a dance, and how do you accommodate these two people who couldn't accommodate each other? It's, you know, it's really challenging.
It's an emotional landmine that you're walking on at all times. And for those people who want to get through the divorce quickly because they just can't take it anymore, the emotion of the divorce, can't deal with my spouse any longer, what I try and do is just look at the logistics of their decisions to make sure that the underpinning is going to sustain itself after the divorce is finalized. Because after the divorce is finalized, that's when everybody starts thinking and they will have decision maker remorse. So just to be sensitive to that, I just ask self-reflective questions. Okay, you're really convinced this is the right thing for you. Okay, so here's how logistically this will work out in these steps. Okay, so you know that's the best I can do for that. For those who can take a break, they are self-sustaining financially, they've got the co-parenting schedule down, great, then take a break, because that's the most sensible thing to do. These are big decisions you're making.
I think what I would suggest, and maybe you're doing this already, if I was going to serve as a mediator, not that I've ever done it in any official capacity, I teach a basic breathing exercise called diaphragmatic breathing. And I think what I would, and no offense, but what I would say, if we're going to do this together, I'm going to teach you a breathing exercise. And every time your partner speaks, I want you to practice this breathing exercise so you can listen. Because it's going to save us time and it's going to save you money. So here's the breathing exercise. You can learn it and practice it. And the purpose is to calm your emotions and make you receptive enough that you can come to the conclusion you want.
Excellent. Excellent. I breathing is underrated.
Yeah, I'm with you.
It really is underrated. I do it to myself. I work in a high anxiety business. And so when I find that I'm meeting my clients at their own emotional level, which is a little too much for me, and it's starting to affect me, I just say, all right, let me take a breath. I don't have to respond right now to their emails or phone calls. I'm allowed to wait until I feel more stable and I can listen to them in a different way. And I don't have to get engaged in their emotion. You have to be careful.
Yeah. You know, I have a website called evolvingcouple.com. And on that website, there are some blogs, 4 or 5 minute blogs. One of them is the breathing exercise. I just call it belly breathing. You can go there and just listen to it. And the challenge for anxiety and anger is to learn to retrain the brain to develop new habit patterns as adults to deal with these emotions. Because we figured out how to deal with our emotions before we were 5 years old. So for you to say, I want to retrain my brain to learn new habits in order to stop some of my old bad ones, breathing is the best thing that you can do for yourself.
Yeah, I agree. I want to, as we're coming into the conclusion of our time together, I want to address vulnerability again. I love that you said anger is the suit of armor we put on, and it protects us from our vulnerable selves. I had a mediation some years ago, and I was just working off of gut instincts. The two people seemed fairly reasonable. They didn't appear to be too angry. And going through the process of dividing the stuff, the house, the pension, this and that. And the husband, very intelligent, worked in the field of law. So I like when I'm dealing with people that are related to what I do. It just puts a different dynamic to the conversation. Anyway, there are still very hurt people. So beyond what they did for a living, very hurt people. So I noticed that there was $1,000 difference in what a true division of the house and the pension would be versus what the husband wanted it to be. And he was stuck on, I'm not giving a penny more. It was $1,000 difference, which was peanuts compared to the value of the house and the pension. And so I said, well, okay, we're at the end of our 2-hour time frame, and it's in the evening now. It was probably around 7 o'clock. I said, let's just adjourn, and I need to think. There's something going on here that I'm not understanding. There's a question I need to ask, and I need time. I need to drive. So let's adjourn. Okay, fine. So as I'm on my way home, I'm thinking, well, why don't I just ask the husband why he's stuck on this $1,000 differential, because we really didn't ask about why. And so I emailed him why when I got home. I rarely do this. And I did it in the old days. I don't do it anymore. Once I'm home, I'm home. But I emailed him and I said, is there an actual reason that you haven't communicated about what's the importance of this $1,000 that you don't want to give up? And he said, yes. The next morning, not that night, the next morning, I woke up to an email. And he said, something I never communicated. He said, I went away for a sabbatical for 6 months, a law sabbatical. And in that time, her mother died. And her mother left her the house that her mother lived in, no mortgage, free and clear of mortgage. And she moved out of our family residence into the mom's house, took all her belongings, never told me. I came home from the sabbatical to a half-empty house. She was gone. And she never apologized, never explained. They never really dealt with it. And so he said that in an email to both of us. And so I said nothing. I waited to see what her response would be. And it was nothing. There was no response. So I called her and I said, I was just wondering if you were going to be responding to what your husband just shared. And she said, am I supposed to? And I said, yes. Yeah, that the only response is from you, not me, from you. He was really addressing you. And she said, okay. So she called him. They went out to dinner and they became vulnerable for the first time in years. And they called me the next day. They said, we no longer need you as a mediator, which I considered a compliment. And here, I'm fine. Here, I'll split it down the middle. No big deal. He needed to talk about it. He needed to share his sadness. And that was really where you want people to be with vulnerability, don't you?
Yeah, it's being able to speak your truth.
Why is it so hard for us to do that, me included?
Well, when we're speaking the truth, to be vulnerable is to take off the shield and to risk being seen or known. We could be hurt. It's that simple. I'm afraid of being hurt. I'm afraid of being dismissed. I'm afraid of being rejected. I'm afraid of being unheard. And so when we can deal with the feelings of loss or pain or suffering, we don't have to hide it anymore. If I know that I can risk asking you for something and I can risk you saying no and deal with the pain, I can ask you. I don't have to walk on eggshells. So it's about dealing with our own feelings, becoming more capable and willing to feel the depth of our emotion. Thomas More wrote a book called Care of the Soul, and I like his definition of soul. He said, soul is the depth of our capacity to experience our humanity. The depth of our capacity. So soul is the potential. It's the depth of our capacity. That is the soul. Feelings are the voice of the soul. So when I'm sharing my feelings with you, I'm letting my soul have a moment. And if you were raised in a family where you were not seen or heard or respected, it's going to take some work for you to take to learn how to take that risk, because you have to learn how to take care of yourself. Lick your own wounds, so to speak.
So to be vulnerable in a relationship where you're on the precipice of to divorce or not divorce, that is the question. To be vulnerable would be the key to the reality of what our next step should be. And if our next step is truly divorce, great. But we would then be divorcing in a much better way, because we would be sharing what we need, who we are and what we need. And maybe that's not being with the other person, but that's okay. It's not blaming. Right?
Right.
Or it can work in the reverse. The vulnerability could be that thing that puts the divorce aside for a while. And let's see if we can re-experience this relationship.
And have a relationship that has as its foundation the willingness to share ourselves that's vulnerable. The willingness to share the depth of our capacity to be a human being with each other. To learn how to deal with how it feels when you feel unheard or dismissed or devalued. And being able to share that with each other without coming at each other with defensiveness or attack or withdrawal and things like that. And so the couple becomes an incredible arena that allows us to explore what it's like to be vulnerable.
I love that.
In a sparring partner. Yeah. We end up as sparring partners, defending and attacking, because we don't know that it's okay to be vulnerable. We don't know that we'll be okay if I trust myself with you. That's a pretty legitimate reason to separate, if I find that I can't be vulnerable with you and you're not interested in me when I am coming toward you with this. That's pretty reasonable in my mind.
Absolutely. So regardless of the outcome on the other side of vulnerability, that's the key. That's the
key is knowing that I can deal with the outcome. I can be vulnerable. Because I don't want to not be vulnerable. I don't want to disrespect myself by hiding anymore and treating myself like I'm a child. I want to be able to say, this is how I feel. This is what it's like for me. Can you receive me? Can you not receive me? That's what's important for me. to be in this relationship. And when I'm working with folks who are deciding whether they want to make, like I have a, what I refer to as a list of non-negotiable demands that you kind of want to have to choose somebody to partner with or to mate with. One that I think should be on everybody's list is the willingness and the ability to take responsibility for your own reactivity. It's not on too many people's lists, but that's what will give you a promise of future. Because the inevitability of dissatisfaction is written into the couple relationship, even if you don't have it in your official marriage contract. People are going to get upset with each other, annoyed by each other, irritated, dismissed, abandoned, blah, blah, blah. There's no way that two egos are not going to have these kinds of things. So to recognize that we're joining together in order to figure out how to grow and mature as human beings and have that as part of what is understood to be the contract of marriage, I think that would avoid a lot of divorce. Preparing up front for the inevitability of these conflicts. So I'm not being pessimistic, I'm just being a developmental psychologist. I'm saying the crises are inevitable. So when they hit, know how to handle them. And the answer is take responsibility for what you're doing, not what your partner is doing or not doing. What am I doing or not doing that's contributing to these patterns in this relationship? That's where the room to change comes from.
I can't imagine that anybody listening to this wouldn't want to follow up with you. This was a really impactful hour.
Oh, good. I'm so glad.
I really loved talking to you. Thank you so much for doing this. And I would like other people to be able to talk to you as well. So could you share your contact information, please?
Sure. My phone number, which is a good way to contact because you can leave me a text, 310-479-1143. 310-479-1143. My website is theevolvingcouple.com. There's about a dozen blogs on there with breathing exercise and mindful listening. It's either evolvingcouple.com or theevolvingcouple.com. And my email address is stevewolf1@verizon.net. stevewolf1@verizon.net.
Thank you so much, Dr. Wolf. This has really been great.
My pleasure.
And thank everybody for listening to Constructive Uncoupling, the podcast devoted to amicable divorces. You can reach me, Judith Weigel, at Judy@constructiveuncoupling.com, Judy@constructiveuncoupling.com, or through my website, divorceresourceinc.com. If you're not already subscribing, please do so. And if you would like others to share in this very valuable information, please do so. Thank you again, and we will talk to you next week.